Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
All right, all right. It's great to be back with you. This is Spike at Origins, broadcasting from Full Service Radio here in the Line Hotel. Thanks, Caleb Stein, for our incredible intro music. And today I'm joined, we're going a little bit outside of our comfort zone, a little bit away from food today, but I'm really excited to be talking about this subject. We're going to be talking clothes, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Good. And I got Chris Coughlin here, proprietor of Franklin and Poe in Philadelphia, PA. And we are together because you provided much of what our team upstairs at Rakes Progress wears, and we have a very interesting kind of opportunity here to expand our thinking around local and local ag and what that can mean to include clothing. But first I want to back up for a second and talk a little bit about what you do up at Franklin and Poe, and then hopefully we'll back into that conversation of how we got here talking about local and what that can mean when it comes to clothing. But thanks for being here.
No, it's great. Thanks for having me. I think really the idea started, Andrew and I, my business partner, Andrew Lee, we started working overseas together. We worked for the U.S. government, and after a few years, it was both time for us to kind of get out and do something else, but we both agreed that really doing something that provided the same level of service, provided the same feedback for us, and the ability to give back and do something that was more than about just a paycheck. And I think a lot of people can resonate with that, right? Like deeper meaning beyond just the biweekly lump sum in your bank account. So for us, we just sort of fell in love. We kind of went down that rabbit hole, started with salvage denim, discovered all these independent makers out there.
And when did all this get rolling?
So we started, about 2009, 2010, that's when the idea started. Discovering brands like Rogue Territory, 316, these guys out in LA just doing some fantastic stuff. And that took off. We still kind of continued our own jobs. Timing wasn't quite right. Fast forward to, 2016. Andrew had quit his job. I actually still work for the government. Maybe quitting will come down the line. And we just went all in, created the shop up in Philly that originally focused only on USA-made goods, but we've decided that for us, ethical manufacturing and sourcing is more important than necessarily country of origin, but we still maintain an incredible focus on sourcing as best we can from the U.S. and then products made in the U.S. And that kind of brings us to where we were. This job really gives us a chance to be a part of a community, and with the beautiful nature of the internet, it's a much larger community, and we feel like we can introduce people specifically in Philly, but to the mid-Atlantic and the world, to all these wonderful products coming from Japan, Germany, and the U.S., stuff that's just made in our backyards.
It seems like a great time to be doing this, and I can go back a few years, and it was probably harder to look if, you know, find a made in the USA garment than it seems to be now. Am I right about that, or is that just kind of an illusion?
No, you're absolutely right about that. I think, there's been sort of a renaissance with made in the USA. It's not just, a symbol. I think it's kind of taking on its own momentum these days. I think people are actually buying into the fact that what we create here has a value much higher than what we've been used to in the past. And this plays into, providing, you know, living wages for people making things. And, you know, people can criticize models like Shinola, but they've done a wonderful thing in retraining people that didn't have jobs prior or didn't have that level of skilled jobs. And so small steps, they're not going to be perfect steps, but creating those small steps that create a much larger picture, I think that's the important key.
Is there a specific reason? I mean, I've been thinking about this so long. from, you know, around local food, and that has expanded recently for me. I think my, you know, where I was at first was around ag. That's where I kind of connected to the idea that the way that we grow our food has a huge environmental impact, and that's why I thought maybe we should be paying attention to this. But then I started, in a sense, looking at everything through that lens of what it could mean to be producing something locally and the benefits. And I'm just wondering where you see this fitting into this economy, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I think it was sort of an awakening, and the project became a product of that awakening. And it just kind of hit me one day as I was shockingly at Woodbury Kitchen. And sitting there looking at the list of farm breweries and the fish pepper sauce that, you know, has rejuvenated a dying pepper, right, in the state of Maryland. And looking at all these things, and it ironically hit me that, one, food and fiber come from the same place. And two, I didn't cognitively realize that connection, that these farmers are creating all of these things from the earth. What we eat and what we wear all come from the same place, and that there's no reason why we can't extend that level of local sourcing to manufacturing. And, you know, maybe this plays into a much larger picture. Maybe we don't get back to that national industry, right? And that's okay. Maybe it's just a regional thing. But imagine little pockets of regionally sourced manufactured goods that all go to sustain that regional economy. It becomes a much more viable long-term option, I think. And I think that you have one thing that you have with that is you have a binding commitment to your community. You have a relationship. You know the farmers. You know the people. You know your neighbors. You know, so you might not agree with them, but you still care that they're a part of your community and that they're a productive part. And that's really where this buys in, is that everybody becomes an integral part of the community again. And we're not just going to big box stores and relying on national manufacturers to provide national good that might not be right for the rest of us.
Right. So there's this benefit, and I think you've done a great job of describing a big part of that. There's probably even more. But there's always going to be a knock on what you do, and I've heard it a million times. And the one I'm specifically referring to is cost, right? And I've heard so many times that my locally sourced, you know, food from the farmer that I know and all that is more than the restaurant down the street. When we put our stuff up on a shelf in a store, it costs more than the stuff that came from elsewhere. It was made in a different way. And I'm sure that you get the same thing around, especially, you know, made in the USA clothes that are significantly more expensive than their made elsewhere counterparts. How do you kind of answer that? I would love to know.
Yeah, I think the quick and easy retort to that to me is how much are you worth? That's the question I ask everybody when that's their question to me. I simply ask back, well, imagine, just take for an instance that you are the one creating this garment. So many people have a hobby that actually creates something. And then I say, well, now imagine trying to commercialize that and live off that. What would you need to live? And that's what these people are doing. Nobody's getting rich off of this job. This is, for many people, it's their passion. It's what they love doing. It's what you love doing at Woodbury and Artifact and what you've done with the local farms. And we think that there's value beyond just the measure of cost, right? You can go anywhere and get a meal, but there are varying levels. And you can go anywhere and get clothing, and there are varying levels of manufacturing. And sometimes the key is simply relating the story behind that production, behind that brand, behind the manufacturing. We need to get people to relate to their neighbors again. And that's really what this is all about, is getting people to understand that we as Americans are worth more than what we have been valuing ourselves at. That going to the big box stores doesn't value your fellow worker. They might create an incredible amount of jobs, but in the long run, that's not long-term, that's not sustainable in the long-term, because we still have systemic unemployment, specifically in urban environments like Baltimore and Philadelphia as well. And for us, it really boils down to worth and how much you value what you're actually buying. Are you just buying it because you don't care about clothing? I'm never going to convince that person to buy these clothes.
But that's part of the conversation too. So I totally agree that, you know, a lot of this is about, you know, the value of the work that goes into something. Mm-hmm. But can we have a conversation about what the garment or the shoe itself, and say this thing is intrinsically worth more? It's going to last longer. This is important to you. It looks better in a way.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's the product has to be something that people like and want to buy. Right. It has to be aesthetically pleasing. It has to be functional. It has to be durable. I think for us in the clothing industry, it's also teaching people to value clothing. There is a throwaway culture when it comes to clothing. Fashion.
I was going to ask you about disposable.
It is the number one or two polluter in the world. You know, we are.
It's discarded clothing.
Yes, discarded clothing. We are actually decimating globally, we are decimating economies in Africa because of this, because we generate this incredible fashion waste. And these local economies, these local creators in Africa, in these African nations, cannot compete with the price of discarded American goods.
Bailed up and shipped out, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. They can't compete with that. I don't want to hyperbole, I don't want to create a whole bunch of hyperbole here, but you really are decimating that economy. You are creating an environment that is unsustainable for local makers. By buying into local makers here, we decrease on waste. I mean, so many people have said it often. I think Vivian Westwood is probably the most famous. And she said, you know, simply buy less and wear more often. And that's the philosophy behind clothing, which has durability, has sustainability. It just has to be there. And it also is going to require an investment in infrastructure. We let that infrastructure go when we started outsourcing in the 80s. And you look at, we're coming up on almost 40 years of outsourcing and what it's... and. We're no longer the experts in so many fields when it comes to fashion. You know, Southeast Asia is crushing us because they have the skilled workers, the skilled labor force, the skilled machines. You know, they have all the machines to do all the technical fabrics. There are a few bigger brands are coming back. Adidas just created a speed factory. I can't recall exactly where in the U.S., but
it's in the States.
But it's in the States, uh-huh. and they're creating sneakers made in the U.S. and they're creating in a speed factory, and it's that's where much of their 3D printing is. And this is a breakthrough for bringing technological fashion and manufacturing back to the U.S. But we have to do this on a much smaller scale because there are independent makers out there, just like local farmers, right? And they're buying their goods from, come to mind, like Huston Textiles out in California. It's veteran owned, and it's one guy who just fell in love with old looms and has started weaving his own fabrics. We've got Flying Shuttle Mills just within 100 miles of here up in PA, and they're doing the same thing. And they're struggling to keep their mills open because the demand for the fabric just isn't there. And I think there has to be a circular nature, just like we do with food, right? I think people need to start thinking about that nature. And that process.
I think it's important to think, you know, when we're talking local, a lot of times it could be a local process. And I always want to ask, well, what's the input there? What is the ingredient that you're making this thing from? And hope that it's a local agricultural ingredient. I'm wondering, what are the chances if I get a made in the USA garment? You talked about the fact that fiber and food come from the same place, agriculture, that I'm going to get grown in the USA fiber in that made in the USA garment.
So it really varies on the fiber, right? So if you're talking hemp is the big new fiber, Young Maven's a big supporter of it, and you're starting to see it become more common in clothing. One of the brands we carry in the store, Left Field, and the region I mentioned, not because he's in the store, but because he's one of the few guys still working with hemp tees, and he's up in Queens. It's just one guy. And the hemp that we create here in the U.S. just can't compete with the hemp from China.
On what? On cost?
On quality, on durability. Uh-huh. And on cost. It's just not cost effective yet. It's getting there, right? But it also is going to take a conscious effort to separate hemp from weed. The two are the two are not the same. You're not going to light up your t-shirt. Let's not get... Hemp is an incredibly durable... ethically sourced, it's much less damaging to the environment than cotton can be. Cotton can also be good for the environment, just depends on how it's farmed.
Uh-huh.
And that brings me then to like Supima cotton. That is just superior Pima, and it's all USA made. It only comes from the US. Pima cotton is the normal brand of Pima cotton that you find in the US. It's a good chance you'll find that. Supima tends to be a little more rare, and the cost is slightly higher. But otherwise, made in the USA typically means with cotton, you're pretty sure it's coming from the US. To import Turkish or Egyptian cotton is just typically not economically cost effective for these companies. So a lot of it comes from Georgia. But as we start getting into, say, denim, right? You could have Italian cotton, you could have US cotton that then got shipped to Japan, rope dyed in indigo, woven, sewn and cut into a pair of jeans and then sent back, or maybe just the denim fabric is woven, comes back to the US, and then gets cut and sewn into denim. And a lot of these processes could just all happen with regional manufacturing here in the US. And they were, you know, you could, it used to be that Cone Mills out of, well, I should say White Oak, the White Oak plant out of Cone Mills, which was their selvage denim factory that just shut down at the end of last year. So literally,
why did they close?
It's been pretty shady, and it was crushing, I think, to those of us in the industry, because we saw the denim mill that supplied denim to Levi's when it first got started go out of business. That was crushing to us, but it also signaled a much larger, I think, a much larger concern in the industry that people were over, that somehow made in the USA was a fad. That this local sustainable model was not something to be perpetuated, but something to be just utilized for a short-term profit and then discarded like all the other fashion waste. And so what we've seen are other companies like Blue Pacific taking up the mantle, Flying Shuttle Mills up the street. They are creating selvedge denim and in small batches, and it's more expensive, but they're continuing that process, that cyclical production cycle, and for us that's key. We, you know, for White Oak, they source their cotton within 90 miles of the factory. They would weave the denim right there in the factory and then send it out to whomever would buy it. You know, almost all of the brands we have in the store would utilize white, you know, Cone Mills denim at some point. I mean, that is just the classic American denim. When you think of blue jeans, that is Cone Mills. It doesn't come from anywhere else. I mean, that is blue jeans through and through. That is Easy Rider. That is, you know, your 70s bell bottoms.
And they're done.
Your 80s punk rock. Yeah, and they're done.
Will they come back, or is there?
You know, nobody knows. They were bought out by a larger corporate conglomerate or a private equity group, I believe. And nobody knows if they're going to come back. And if they do come back, what shape or form that would take. But when you look at, when you follow their Instagram, when you follow what they're putting out, they don't say that there's any future there. You know, they're not, which is sad. You know, it's truly, that was, you think of the things that are iconically American, apple pie, baseball, and blue jeans, and jazz. You know, those things, you know, for years, farmers were tooling around in overalls and denim made by Levi's, and they still are. That's the same denim.
Wow.
Except over the years, Levi's
moved a lot of production.
Yeah, they moved a lot of production, right? Cone Mills has production in Mexico, and they have production in China. And I'm not criticizing that. I don't think globalization is a bad thing. But I think there are ways that we can integrate regional manufacturing and production in smart ways. And they'll never be as cheap as those globalized products. But you can guarantee that you'll see the improvement in your communities. You'll see the improvement in the regional stability.
So for us, regionally, that means Flying Shuttle, right? This mill that's up in where? Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's up just west of Lancaster, PA. David Mullen. David Mullen, the owner of Safe Khaki, actually owns this mill.
Right.
And we're excited to be working with them and you, obviously, on this new project. That kind of ties in with food and fiber coming from the same place. When you took the leap to actually say, let's take a little experiment and let's source some of these, our uniforms from American made companies. Let's make everything here. And we take baby steps. It's not perfect, but now we have, now we actually have an ability to possibly source and make uniforms within 100 miles of this restaurant, which is mind-blowing. That just doesn't exist.
Or it didn't. And, you know, I've gotten so used to that in a good way of things moving in the right direction a lot of times, sometimes not. But, you know, we try to create a tabletop in our restaurants that's 100% American-made. And if we can, even closer, you know, even or regionally made. It turns out there's only one factory in the whole country that still makes flatware, silverware, you know, knives, forks, and spoons.
Right.
Left. And that's and so we just use them. It's actually been kind of nice because I don't have to worry so much about picking out a flatware pattern. It's just like, we're going to use these guys, and that's the end of the story. We've
right.
got like six patterns, and we'll pick one, and no big deal. But it seems like, I don't know if we could have had the conversation about local uniforms. Maybe we tried, even a few years ago. But
yeah, I don't, you know, I think if we had it, it would have been a more of a what if than
right.
than a hey look. And I think we're still a little bit in that what if spot, right? We're still reaching out. We're still establishing these relationships. We're still figuring out, you know, how long did it take us to discover that there is a 100-year-old factory still manufacturing in Essex, Maryland? And there is a, I think that there's a community around food that doesn't yet exist in fashion. Rather than collaboration, which we see on the surface, right? One brand will collaborate with another. But when you deep dive into the manufacturing side, there is a reticence to share that information.
Right.
When I think we should be blabbing about it on every single channel. We should be, I shouldn't, you know, close hold that information about the factory with which I'm producing. I should share it with everyone, because if they get more business, all of our costs come down.
Right.
And that might mean more competition, but that's not a bad thing. You should be secure in what you're creating. You should be secure in the products that you're putting out there. And if you're not, well then maybe the problem, you know, maybe the problem needs to be addressed elsewhere. Because to me, we should be, these factories and mills that we, that are so hard to find should be as easy to find as the farms at your local farmer market. In fact, I hope we establish something like that. Let's get local mills and manufacturers and say, hey, let's have a fiber market that comes out and essentially is the same farmer market. And we start showcasing what people are manufacturing and sourcing and growing and weaving.
I'm wondering, because we have a word for it, you know, in the food side of things, we have locavores, right? That
yeah.
that seek out local food, and thank God they make a point of buying local food at their farmers markets and in restaurants. And I'm wondering if there's enough of a local, you know, kind of the same thing. In are there locavore clothing shoppers?
Oh.
You know, are there people? I know, and I'll say, like, I'll go into a shop and make a big show of, like, I'm not going to buy this. It's not from here.
Yeah.
Just so they know that there's somebody paying attention and looking at the tag and saying, like, I'd rather, you know, have something that's made in the U.S. Do you have anything that was made here?
Well, so currently I would say the closest, at least in the retail shop, the closest we have that's made here would be up in New York City. Right. But
I'm asking about the shopper that's coming into your shop and saying,
Oh yeah. Like those people.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. We have people that
there's a market for it.
Oh, there's an absolute market for it. In fact, when we were pitching our business plan, the feedback we got time and time again is, why do you need a brick and mortar? And we didn't, of course, have the data at the time. We just felt intrinsically that a brick and mortar was the right thing to do. And the opportunity came across to do it. And we're glad we did. I would say on average, 2/3 of our sales are brick and mortar. 1/3 is online. And that's not just us. That is... you know, I've talked to other shop owners, and for them, it's the same thing. The people that buy these clothes, they want to know the owners. They want to know the brands. They want to be able to nerd out with you about this fiber or that fiber, this denim or that denim. They want to have an argument with you about which one is better and why. And I welcome those. And I know Andrew, who sits at the shop every day, that is the highlight of his day when customers come in. Specifically the new customers and are just looking to support a local business, and they find us and it opens up a whole new world for them. And those are the people that you see the look in their eye and they're just like, I just didn't know this existed. And then we have the people that know this exists, and they come in and they just want to be surrounded by this stuff because it took time to make the things in our shop. There's nothing fast about anything we do, and there's a term out there called slow fashion. And I think that's the way our shop operates, right? The internet is all about fast, but nothing we sell is about fast. And I think that's why for us and for businesses like us, the shop experience is a slow pace. It is patient and comfortable and welcoming, and you hang out and you get to know us, you get to know the makers, you get to know the fabric and the clothes, and then or the bags or whatever it is you want, and then you can leave and not buy anything, and that's just fine with us. But maybe someday down the road you will come back, like you'll give that next purchase a little more thought, and that's the beginning, right? So if we can at least get them in the store and start getting them to think slightly differently and showing them that there's a different pace to fashion. I mean, when is a pair of blue jeans or a white t-shirt ever gone out of style, right? Never. But if you can make that t-shirt and those denim last for years, those people will always come back. They're not going to come back every year, or maybe they will, but they'll buy something different, which is what we want. You know, for example, the shirt I'm wearing now is 8 years old. Still looks like I just bought it a week ago. This guy, Christopher Taylor, out of Taylor Supply Company, sort of had a great rocket start and then just sort of died off. And I think it just was part of that, sort of got consumed by cost effectiveness and manufacturing and trouble sourcing. But to this day, it is absolutely still my favorite shirt. I probably shouldn't say that to all the brands in my store, but yeah, it's... we all have those shirts, and I think that's what we want people to recognize, that you can come in at any time and we hope you walk out with your new favorite shirt. And that's really what this is about, or new favorite item, it doesn't matter. And maybe you won't be back off or every day, that's fine. But for us, it's really more about buy less and wear more often.
How awesome is that to hear? What else is, what's hot right now? I mean, I got this guy that... in the studio that's right, you know, on the cutting edge of fashion world, at least for guys. Or do you have women's clothes too?
Okay. So women's, when we started our women's line, it really made me realize how little I know about women, which my wife will certainly love to hear, like that I'm actually admitting this on air. Women's is a tougher road for us, and we're probably gonna pause on it for a little bit, but I think we're going to continue in a different way and then figure out the way forward, but we won't give up on that. But for now, the men's side is doing very strong. And the men's are easier, right? You know, for women, one pair of denim will fit one woman. For men, one pair of denim will fit a million guys.
Right.
Men are just easier. Sometimes you have to make those sacrifices to make sure the business gets through. Some things take priority. And so that's kind of where we're at. We're still growing. We're only about a year and a half old. So for us, the growth we've seen is incredible, and with the fashion that's coming in.
So any of the American brands that you want to give a shout out to that you're excited about?
Well, I mean, there are a ton. So Freenote Cloth out in LA, those guys just do amazing. I would say Easy Rider meets California Surf, probably even American Western. So think, what's the old... HBO Western. I'll have to think about it, but it'll come to Deadwood. There we go.
Deadwood. Oh, wow.
So think Deadwood, California Surf, and Easy Rider all in one shop. That's pretty much how I think of a Freenote. Rogue Territory, Carl, he's been doing this. He cut his teeth over at AB Fitz back in the day, which is just a legendary shop. American Rag, sorry, out of LA, not AB Fitz. AB Fitz is out of San Francisco, but American Rag out of LA. Let's see, Velveteen, man. So Top One is the manufacturing company, but they basically took over Velveteen and created and are still creating legendary T-shirts. They're all tubular knit. They don't lose their shape. They don't bag out. I still have a T-shirt made by Velveteen that I was given. I was issued in the Army back in 1996, and I still have it. No holes. Still going strong. I wouldn't wear it out in public, but it's probably got some permanent, you know, funk to it just from being in Foot Lockers for years. But
did that shirt have anything to do with you getting? Is there some line we can connect back to that T-shirt?
Or? I mean, It did, actually. When we started this idea that, well, one, I just couldn't believe that I still had a Velveteen shirt from that long ago. But that was at the core of what was, I think, longevity, durability, support to American companies, and service was all kind of rolled up into this big jumble of an idea to start this shop. And the retail aspect seemed like the right way because we could support the most makers at one time. You know, the collaboration we're doing with you and the uniforms and reaching out to Flying Shuttle and things like that, that's the natural extension of this, and the side that really gets me excited, because this is the side where we start to create jobs
and, exactly,
and an infrastructure that is greater than us. And that is the stuff that just like keeps me up at night when I'm trying to fall asleep, and I just think, what if we had this and this?
I've come to believe that institutions have such an important role to play because they have the resources, and a lot of times a single decision that's made in an institution can have such a huge effect, say on food. If a school decides to feed kids in a certain way and maybe focus on local, all of a sudden that's a big win for farmers. You have maybe an interesting perspective or a perspective on this. Does the U.S. Army favor Made in the USA
right
for their uniforms?
It does, yeah. So, and that's actually mandated. So the U.S. Army, the military has to buy from U.S. manufacturers. A few years ago, there was a big to-do about the U.S. They switched all the soldiers to berets. And when they switched to berets, turns out the berets were actually made in China. And it was a huge, everybody in the military recognized this, probably outside too, but it was a huge snafu. So they had to get rid of those berets and go with an American manufacturing company. And this, you know, unfortunately with contracts at large, you know, people will criticize contracts at large, big and small, because they think the government gets undercut, or depends on your side of the argument, right? But to me, ensuring that type, this isn't a subsidy. This is buying a commodity, and this is legitimate. I'm not going to go so far as to say it's national security, but it's in the national interest to support American manufacturing in that way, because heaven forbid we end up in another war and all of a sudden we rely on another country for all of our uniform needs. Who does that then? What happens? We have no skilled laborers. We have nobody who can do that. I mean, right. Heaven forbid we ever get in that situation again. But there is a security aspect to it. Something that just seems very odd when you're talking about clothing. But you know, it'd be really weird having naked soldiers run around with weapons. It's not going to hold. They're not going to win too many wars that way.
I don't know what war you're fighting at that point.
Yeah.
But a lot of what we do leads back can lead back. You know, we're thinking about food, ideas of food security, and I think it makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I purposely drive through. I work out near BWI on my real job, but I purposely take random ways home just to see different parts of Baltimore that I've never seen. And I drive through parts of Baltimore that just break my heart. Just swaths and acres of abandoned row homes, and the only thing in the end is the local corner shop, and not a single grocery store in sight, not a single legitimate retail shop. And I'm not saying it has to be like a retail shop like we own, just business, commerce, community. And I just don't recognize that as, you know, how do we let that happen here? And to me, that is a reminder to me every day that the changes might be slow. They might be mind-bogglingly bureaucratic, depending upon where you're going, and frustrating. Lots of times frustrating, but it's worth it. Even the small steps. You create a small step, somebody else wants to get in, and then it creates a bigger step. And I think we just need to start looking at collaborative capitalism and not competitive capitalism. The two don't have to be mutually exclusive, right? There's enough out there for all of us to generate good products and to provide living wages to the people. You know, it's not an argument about minimum wage. Why aren't we creating industry? Why aren't we creating these other things? And I'm sure people will argue and say that we are doing those things, right? It's just hard for me to see. Maybe I haven't seen it, but...
No, I think we're still fully capable of creating businesses and ignoring the possible upside for the entire country.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why people do that.
Well, and And here's the thing, I think we need to start small, and I think we need to look at these problems locally and say, we don't need to fix the country. We need to fix Baltimore, or we need to fix Philly. And then we go from there, right? We branch out and we say, well, hey, this one mill needs help. Let's start there. And when they're going and we can give them our business and other business, then we branch out and say, hey, what if, you know, this factory is doing our things, but they need more workers. Can you train them? Can you get them up to speed? I mean, it goes back to training. You look at towns like Baltimore and Philly that are historically industrial towns, that a skilled labor force was generational, and that's no longer the case because of outsourcing. But that doesn't mean we can't create that again. And you look at the rise of crime, and you look at the exodus out of Baltimore. And I'm only using Baltimore example because I live there and I know it's
better. A good example, though. I mean, for better or worse,
it is, right. Yeah. But it Detroit, Philly, Chicago, right? They're all having these issues, and frankly, the infrastructure can be there, right? We need to stop looking for an immediate return, and we need to think down the road that we might not see a return on this in 5 years, but we'll start to see a little in 10. We'll start to see even more in 20 as you start to create communities, as you address food deserts. And they're huge issues to me when access to fast industrial waste food is more accessible and cheaper than tomatoes grown a few miles away, you know, outside of, you know, you 5 minute drive outside of Baltimore and you are in some of the most beautiful farmland in the world, and how that doesn't reach all of Baltimore just blows me away. And I'm sure
it frustrates me.
Well, so in the fashion industry, it was the same, right? And I think what frustrates me more is the fact that so many people are not willing to share. I feel, and I could be wrong here, but I feel like a lot of restaurants share farms. They share goods, and there's a great community around it, right? You're not going to like everybody, but you're never going to wish ill on another business or stop them from growth, right? Like, this is what makes other restaurants stronger, makes you stronger. And because that farm gets stronger, they can plant more, prices come down, they earn more money. Like, it just creates a much more sustainable long-term ecosystem. And that's the same for fashion, but it's not there yet. It's too competitive. It's very much a close hold. This is mine. I don't want to reveal, you know, I don't know if I know you yet. I sort of understand those things, but at the same time, we have to take risks. We really got to support that local fiber growth.
Well, I think we're on the right track. I'm really happy that our team gets to look as good as they do in the clothes that you're helping get them into. And I really appreciate you coming down and talking about this.
No, it's
great.
Let's
keep in touch and let's talk again as we go down this road.
That sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Spike.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.